Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, April 6, 2022. Executives from large oil companies pressed by members of Congress about high gasoline prices, and the debate taking a familiar ring, Democrats accusing the companies of price gouging, Republicans saying that it's the Biden administration environmental policies that have led to less oil production. Could high inflation and the turmoil from Russia's continuing war in Ukraine push the U.S. and maybe the world into recession? We'll talk about that with a reporter from MarketWatch. Russian President Vladimir Putin's daughter, wife and daughter of Russia's top diplomat, and Russia's two largest banks among the targets of a new round of sanctions announced today by President Joe Biden. Amid the allegations, Russia is committing war crimes against civilians in Ukraine. U.S. House representatives debating a bipartisan bill designed to ensure the U.S. does everything it can to prosecute any Russian war crimes. U.S. House today also voting to recommend two more of former President Donald Trump's advisors be held in criminal contempt for not complying with subpoenas from the House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Those two, Peter Navarro and Dan Scavino. This from United Press International, UPI. Democrats and Republicans squared off during a House committee hearing with some of the leading figures in the petroleum industry Wednesday, taking familiar sides during testimony that highlights the struggle to bring down high gasoline prices. Democrats hammered oil executives over dividends to shareholders, stock buybacks, and CEO pay, while gas prices have hovered at record highs. Republicans defended the oil industry, charging it has been President Joe Biden's rush to green energy that has cut the legs from under the industry and currently prevents them from producing more oil and lowering prices. That from UPI. We covered the hearing in its entirety on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with an opening statement from one of the witnesses, Chevron Chair and CEO Mike Wirth, who says it's Russia's war in Ukraine that's been affecting the market.
In addition to the toll on human life, the crisis has also led to a surge in commodity prices, particularly with respect to energy. It is affecting people around the world, including here in the United States. This has added to the tremendous pressures that our economy and citizens were already experiencing from a global pandemic. At Chevron, we understand the hardship that rising energy costs have posed for so many Americans, from higher prices at the pump to increased rates for natural gas, heating, and electricity. And as the global landscape continues to evolve, we're focused on doing our part to provide Americans with access to affordable, reliable, and ever cleaner energy. I also want to be very clear about where Chevron stands. We do not control the market price of crude oil or natural gas, nor of refined products like gasoline and diesel fuel. And we have no tolerance price gouging.
Mike Wirth is Chevron Chair and CEO, one of the witnesses before today's House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations hearing. The subcommittee chair is Diana DeGette, Democrat from Colorado. She asked why, if oil supply controls prices, when prices went up, when supply was low due to the COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns, prices have not gone down now that supply is back up. You're going to hear answers from Mike Wirth from Chevron, also BP America Chair David Lawler.
So one of the things that has confused me, as I said in my opening statement, and it's making people mad, is why are gas prices still high even after crude oil prices came down? And this is the chart. I don't know if you can see it on Zoom, but you can see how when price per barrel of oil went down, the price per gallon of gas stayed the same. I don't get that. So I want to ask you, Mr. Lawler, BP operates a number of gas stations in the U.S. and internationally. So, Mr. Lawler, can you explain? People are saying, well, we don't own the gas stations, but actually BP does. Why is there such a disconnect between the drop in cost of crude oil and the much slower drop in the price of gas at the pump?
Thank you, Congresswoman. So just as a point of clarity, you know, BP has branded stations here in the United States of around 7,500 or so. And only about 10% of those stations do we operate.
Okay, so maybe you can tell me, why is there a disconnect between the drop in cost of crude oil and the fact gas prices are staying the same?
Yes, happy to do so. So as
very
shared
briefly,
earlier,
I have another question. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. It is a very complex set of factors that impact the price of gasoline. So for example, the price of oil that's entering a refinery could have been purchased at a higher price, and therefore that price then flows through all the way to the station. It's not necessarily an instantaneous market. There's also quite a reflection of supply risk. So we talked about just a moment ago that crude oil supplies are down. That actually applies to all refined products, whether that's jet, diesel, gasoline, and that supply risk is impacting local
markets. So you're saying that the price at the pump may be higher because of jet fuel prices? Is that one of the factors you're saying?
What I'm saying is that all refined products at this point carry a supply risk,
okay,
which is part of the complex pricing equation that impacts prices at the pump.
Okay. Can any of the rest of you in the 41 seconds I have left tell me if you have an idea why price per barrel of oil is falling, but price at the pump is still staying just as high? Anyone else?
Congresswoman, I think President Biden did a pretty good job explaining this last week during his comments when he announced the intent to release oil from the strategic reserve. And he talked about the fact that across the supply chain, these prices flow. Oil and product prices are correlated over time. But at the retail level, the cost that a retailer has paid for fuel a week or 2 weeks prior and the cost that they may need to pay to resupply all factor into the competition, the pricing that you see at the pump. And so these things do correlate over the long term, but in the short term, they don't always move in tandem.
Except for here, they did correlate. So the president was talking about the relief he's going to give to the American taxpayers and the American citizens at the pump. The SPRO is a short-term solution to that.
Congresswoman Diana DeGette, Democrat from Colorado, chair of the subcommittee, Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, holding today's hearing. You heard answers from Mike Wirth of Chevron, David Lawler from BP America. President Biden did order release of 1 million barrels of oil per day from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or SPRO, for the next 6 months. Reuters writes that U.S. gas prices surged after Russia invaded Ukraine and Western countries slapped sanctions on Moscow's energy exports. Pump prices hit a record before inflation adjustments of $4.33 a gallon on March 11th, and since then have slipped about 4% to $4.17 a gallon on Wednesday, today, according to AAA. International crude prices have dropped far more steeply from a peak of more than $139 a barrel in early March to $107 on Tuesday, fall of 23%. More from the hearing, the ranking Republican on the subcommittee is Morgan Griffith of West Virginia. He puts the blame for high gas prices on President Biden's policies.
The president says he wants to make sure that we do not lower the cost of production. Is that going to make you produce more or less? Mr. Woods, more or less?
I think the government has a role in encouraging investment and creating a positive investment climate.
And when we create a negative climate, you produce less. Isn't that true? Yes or no?
There tends to be a chilling effect with negative
words.
There you go.
Mr. Wirth, you want to weigh in on this and give me a real answer? Yes or no? Is that hurting the production, or does that encourage you to produce when the president says in his budget document, not funding work that directly subsidizes fossil fuels, including work that lowers the cost of production, lowers the cost of consumption. That'd be the consumers that Mrs. DeGette's been complaining about having to pay these high prices, and they don't want to lower those prices. And when you hear statements like that, do you increase production? Yes or no?
Congressman, mixed messages from the government do not encourage us to make investments with confidence in future supply.
Well, and I appreciate you don't want to get stuck with answers, but the bottom line is that's not a mixed message. That's a clearly anti-fossil fuel message from the President of the United States at a time when he claims he wants increasing production. All right. President Biden recently has begun to stress short-term need to increase oil and natural gas output and expedite LNG, liquefied natural gas, project development. But in his fiscal year 23 budget request, it focuses almost entirely on transitioning away from fossil fuels. It even proposes tax hikes on oil and gas production. The proposal alleges that oil, gas, and coal tax preferences distort markets by encouraging more investment in the fossil fuel sector than would occur under a neutral system. The provision also alleges that this market distortion is detrimental to long-term energy security and is inconsistent with the administration's policy of supporting a clean energy economy. Are those proposed tax hikes on the oil and gas industry an incentive to explore and develop more domestic production? What say you, Mr. Sheffield?
Less production.
Mr. Moncrief. More or less production?
Less production.
All right. Thank you.
Congressman Morgan Griffith, Republican, West Virginia, ranking member on the subcommittee holding today's hearing. You heard from Darren Woods, CEO of ExxonMobil, Mike Wirth, Chair and CEO of Chevron, Scott Sheffield, Pioneer Natural Resources, CEO, Richard Moncrief, Devon Energy Corporation, CEO, also there. The head of Shell, and H.R. McMaster, former National Security Advisor to President Trump. We covered the entire hearing, House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee, on C-SPAN Radio, and you can find the video archive at cspan.org. The Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warning today that if Russia's war in Ukraine continues, it threatens enormous economic repercussions for the world. She testified before the House Financial Services Committee. She says specifically disruptions in food and fuel supplies will inflict large burdens on countries least able to deal with it.
Spillovers from the crisis are heightening economic vulnerabilities in many countries that are already facing higher debt burdens and limited policy options as they recover from COVID-19. The IFIs will play a critical role in several areas. First, food security. Together, Russia and Ukraine account for nearly a third of the world's wheat exports. Russia's invasion disrupted the flow of food for millions of people around the world and caused prices to spike. The IFIs and food security funds are already working to address both the short-term and long-term effects of the invasion on global food prices and supplies. Second, energy security. The invasion of Ukraine has also underscored the need for sustainable, affordable, clean, and secure energy for economic growth and security for the United States, as well as for governments that partner with the IFIs. The MDB's promotion of energy efficiency and capital investment toward diverse energy sources like solar, wind, and other non-fossil fuel-based energy sources, and away from suppliers such as Russia, that strengthens energy security and reduces short-term fossil fuel price risks, all while addressing the long-term threat of climate change.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen before the House Financial Services Committee in Washington. A headline at MarketWatch.com reads, "Here's the first Wall Street recession call of the new inflation era." Reporter on that story is Stephen Goldstein, markets editor for Europe for MarketWatch, and he joins us from London. Thanks so much for being here. Where did that recession call come from, and could there be more to follow?
Yeah, well, it's a combination of factors. The first is that there was an inflation issue heading into the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There was elevated inflation. This was making the Federal Reserve nervous around the beginning of the year. And it was also giving consumers pause, as shown by a different consumer sentiment survey. Then came the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. And what that had led to is really crippling sanctions on Russia, but also a very big impact on key commodities, notably in energy, but also in food that Russia and Ukraine produce. And this has accelerated what had already been a very big inflation problem. So you put the two together, and you have a situation where the Federal Reserve has communicated that they're going to have to increase interest rates aggressively. And there's one other element, that this is not simply a United States issue. And Deutsche Bank is forecasting that the European Central Bank also will be increasing interest rates aggressively. And that's very noteworthy because right now their interest rates are actually set at a negative level. But the inflation problems are global, and this is really having a major impact on economies, not just in the U.S., but throughout the world.
I have this image in my head of a speeding train, Federal Reserve trying to put on the brakes. Can they put on enough of the brakes, or is it going too fast at this point?
Yeah, that's a great question, and there's really some debate from some very influential people about that. So Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell insists that they can. He gave a recent speech arguing that the U.S. Has in the past and has a strong possibility of engineering what he called a soft or soft-ish landing. And this would mean that the Fed would be able to bring inflation down without causing the U.S. economy to go into a tailspin. Others, like former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, say that just won't be the case, and that the Fed's increasing interest rates will cause such a sharp impact on the U.S. and global economy that a recession or something very close to it is almost assured.
Does it matter at this point how long Russia's war in Ukraine goes on? Because some experts have said in the past couple of days this could go on for years. And also how long the sanctions on Russia are continuing, or is the initial shock of it already baked in?
No, I think it does matter. And I think that last point you mentioned about the sanctions is actually very important as well. Really, the issue is that the world is turning its back on the key commodities produced by Russia. You had today even some Chinese companies saying that they were not willing to buy some energy products from Russia. So the longer that this goes on, Russia is just such a major producer of these vital commodities that even if they were to withdraw, which honestly doesn't look particularly likely, the fact that these sanctions will remain in place is really going to upset the global economy for some time to come. Clearly, the sooner that hostilities cease, the better it will be. Also, that would unlock potentially some very key grain commodities that Ukraine produces that just obviously are not going to get to the world markets during a war. But right now, we're seeing the U.S. and its allies in Europe increasing sanctions on Russia, and particularly with these key commodities. And that's just really further exacerbating an inflation problem that was already there before this crisis.
Stephen Goldstein is the markets editor for Europe at MarketWatch. Find his stories at marketwatch.com and on Twitter at MKTW Goldstein. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll have more on the newest sanctions from the U.S. against Russia later in this program. Wall Street today, the Dow down 144, NASDAQ down 315, S&P down 43. From CNBC, Federal Reserve officials discussed how they want to reduce their trillions in bond holdings at the March meeting with a consensus around $95 billion a month. Minutes released Wednesday showed. Officials generally agreed a maximum of $60 billion in treasuries and $35 billion in mortgage-backed securities would be allowed to roll off, phased in over 3 months, and likely starting in May. President Joe Biden signing into law today a Postal Service reform bill expected to save almost $50 billion over the next decade. The Postal Service has been operating at a net annual loss for the last decade. Saving that money will require no longer requiring prepaying future retiree health benefits to the Postal Service. Instead, the retirees will enroll in Medicare, also allowing the Postal Service to offer non-postal government services like hunting and fishing licenses or services from the Department of Motor Vehicles. President Biden extending the COVID-19 pandemic moratorium on federal student loan payments and interest accrual through August 31st. It was set to expire May 1st. Moratorium began in March 2020 under former President Trump and has since been extended five times, freezing $1.6 trillion in debt owed by more than 40 million Americans. More on this today from the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
On his first day in office, President Biden directed the Department of Education to pause federal student loan repayments through September of that year. He has since extended it twice, today being the third extension. Millions of Americans were struggling, of course, at that time to stay afloat. Because of the pause in repayments, 41 million Americans were able to breathe a little easier during some of the toughest days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, America is stronger than we were a year ago, and we will be stronger a year from now than we are today. However, as our administration recognized in recently extending the COVID-19 national emergency, we are still recovering from the pandemic and the unprecedented economic disruption it caused, which of course, is the root reason for this extension. In order to enable Americans to continue to get back on their feet after two of the hardest years this nation has ever faced, we have announced earlier today, of course, the extension of the pause on federal student loan repayments through August 31st of this year. That additional time will assist borrowers in achieving greater financial security and support the Department of Education's efforts to continue improving student loan programs.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki in the White House briefing room. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, tweeting, President Biden's perpetual student loan payment moratorium is an insult to every American who responsibly paid debts. There's no free lunch. This reckless move puts taxpayers on the hook for billions. The U.S. Senate still on track for a confirmation vote for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson by Friday. TheHill.com reports that a group of Democratic lawmakers unveiled legislation on Wednesday that would force the Supreme Court to adopt various ethics standards, including recusal requirements for justices with financial and personal ties to parties involved in cases before the high court. The effort led by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island.
A Supreme Court justice is now not required to address why he or she doesn't think he or she needs to recuse. And if a party thinks that they really ought to have recused, they have no recourse. Everybody knows the problem of being judge in one's own cause. The justices are judges in their own cause as to recusal. There's no penalty for getting a recusal wrong. And the level of analysis is very weak. In the case of Americans for Prosperity Foundation versus Bonta, which was a very important dark money decision, the court seems to have paid no attention to the fact that Americans for Prosperity and the Americans for Prosperity Foundation are effectively identical organizations. That is a corporate veil you could pierce with a banana. And this law would require them to look through those corporate veils. We also see flotillas of amicus briefs appear, again, from organizations that don't really exist, whose purpose is only to hide who the real interest is behind them. And they appear in flotillas of a dozen at a time, coordinated and orchestrated. And in the case of AFPF, because it was so important to the dark money operation, 50 of these organizations turned up at the certiorari stage. Another point has to do with personal hospitality. The court is now allowing its members to accept personal hospitality. I put the word personal in quotes because it's allowed to accept personal hospitality from people the justice has never met at commercial resorts and facilities. How could that possibly make any sense?
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island, news conference on Capitol Hill with other Democratic senators and House members introducing that legislation. Supreme Court issuing a ruling today. New York Times writes the court reinstated an environmental regulation from the Trump administration that restricted the role states play in enforcing the Clean Water Act. The court's brief, unsigned order gave no reasons, which is typical when the justices act on an emergency application. That from the Times. They also note that four justices dissented, saying the majority had used a case on what critics call the court's shadow docket to issue a significant ruling without adequate consideration. Those four dissenters, Elena Kagan, Chief Justice John Roberts, Stephen Breyer, and Sonia Sotomayor. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. United States on Wednesday tightened the financial vise on Russia, writes the Associated Press, announcing sanctions that target President Vladimir Putin's two adult daughters and block two key Russian banks in retaliation for war crimes in Ukraine. Videos and images of bodies in the streets of Bucha after it was recaptured from Russian forces have unleashed a wave of indignation among Western allies who have drawn up new sanctions as a response. That from AP. President Biden announcing the new sanctions in a speech to the North America's Building Trades Union Legislative Conference in Washington.
First, the United States will impose full blocking sanctions on Sberbank, by far the largest financial institution in Russia, and Alpha Bank, its largest private bank. We're locking down any accounts, any funds that those banks hold in the United States. They'll not be able to touch any of their money. They'll not be able to do any business here. And second, I'm going to sign an executive order that's going to ban any new U.S. investment in Russia. More than 600 private sector companies. Folks, corporate America is stepping up and change. From McDonald's to Exxon, they've left the Russian market on their own accord, 600 of them. Think about that. The private businesses choosing to leave Russia rather than risk being associated with Putin's brutal war. And this ban on investment is going to make sure that new money can't come into Russia to replace what's left so that Russian economy doesn't feel the loss and the loss of these businesses for the long term. Third, we're adding more critical state-owned enterprises to the list of fully blocked Russian companies. These companies are major revenue generators owned by Russian government, which Putin uses to fund himself and enable his war in Ukraine. They'll also be cut off from doing any business with the United States. They'll not be able to access or use any assets they have in the United States. And fourth, we, along with our European allies, are adding the names of the list of Russian elites and their families that we're sanctioning. You see these yachts where they're being picked up? No, think about it. Think about the incredible amounts of money these oligarchs have stolen. These yachts are millions and millions of dollars. Look, these oligarchs and their family members are not allowed to hold on to their wealth in Europe and the United States and keep these yachts worth hundreds of millions of dollars, their luxury vacation homes, while children in Ukraine are being killed, displaced from their homes every single day. And finally, we're continuing to supply Ukraine with the weapons resources they need to defend their country. Last Friday, we announced millions in funding to procure new equipment for Ukraine. Advanced drones, laser-guided rocket systems. Yesterday, I signed another package to send more Javelin missiles, those shoulder-mounted missiles that can take out tanks and armored vehicles. To keep getting an uninterrupted supply to the Ukrainian military. You know, we won't be able to advertise every piece of security we give because our allies and partners are supplying to Ukraine through us. But advanced weapons and ammunition are flowing in every single day. And as you may have seen yesterday on television, when the Secretary of Defense was being cross-examined by one of our, how can I say it, our congresspersons, saying, what have you done? And he basically looked at him and said, what the hell you think we've done? Why do you think you're able to fight? We've trained them and we've given them the weapons. That's what's happening. Look, thanks to the the bravery, the grit, and the fighting spirit of the Ukrainian people, Russia has already failed in its initial war aims. Russia wanted to take Ukraine's capital city, Kyiv, and topple its democracy and elected government. Today, Kyiv still stands, and that government still presides. This fight is far from over. Here's the point. This war could continue for a long time, but the United States will continue to stand with Ukraine and the Ukrainian people in the fight for freedom.
President Joe Biden today at the North America's Building Trades Union Legislative Conference in Washington, D.C. He went on to talk about domestic issues, the U.S. economy. You can find the full speech at cspan.org. A new Pew Research Center survey released today finds 70% of Americans view Russia as an enemy of the United States. That's up about 30 percentage points from January. 24% of those surveyed see Russia as a competitor. 3% consider Russia to be a partner of the United States. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, responding today to the president's announcement of the latest sanctions against Russia. Senator Cotton was on Fox News Channel.
Better late than never, but gosh, it sure is late. The president celebrated the sanctions that we're putting on Russia's largest bank. We've been urging him to impose those sanctions since this war started 7 weeks ago. And not just Republicans either. Democrats have been urging him. I've personally been in closed settings where Democratic senators have urged the administration to sanction that bank. Why has it taken 7 weeks? In fact, why are there any new sanctions to announce at all on Russia? We should have thrown the kitchen sink at Russia and imposed every sanction we could weeks ago. Likewise, with the delivery of arms, again, it's better late than never, but it's consistently been late. The administration has consistently been behind the power curve, both in deploying the arms late last fall when Russia's buildup and intentions were clear, and since the invasion occurred. We're still not doing enough to get Ukraine every weapon system they need and get it fast enough, and we are still imposing limitations on what Ukraine can do on its own territory. Russia has announced that their main effort is now going to be in eastern Ukraine, an area called the Donbas. The administration still thinks that Ukraine should not be allowed to strike Russian forces that were occupying their territory the day before this war started. That is the height of folly. You can't win a war on the defensive. You have to win it on the offensive. We have to encourage and aid Ukraine to go on offense to retake its own territory.
Republican Senator Tom Cotton on Fox News Channel today. In the U.S. House, a bipartisan bill coming up designed to hold Russian leaders accountable for any potential war crimes in Ukraine. The bill is titled Ukraine Invasion War Crimes Deterrence and Accountability Act and was introduced by the top Democrat and Republican on the Foreign Affairs Committee. And both spoke before the vote in the House floor. First, Gregory Meeks, Democrat from New York. He chairs the committee.
Nothing we do on this floor today will erase the generational trauma that Putin's forces have inflicted on Ukrainians. But we can and we must ensure that the United States of America is doing everything in its power to collect evidence that can be used to prosecute Russian war crimes and other atrocities. And hopefully that will deter further systemic human rights abuses in this conflict. H.R. 7276 would require the administration to detail efforts to collect, analyze, and preserve evidence of war crimes, and to describe the process through which a domestic, foreign, or international court or tribunal could request and obtain information related to war crimes or other atrocities from the United States. Every day of this illegal and unprovoked war further unites the global community against Russia's aggression in Ukraine. The images we continue to see day in and day out are shocking to the conscience and also a call to action.
Congressman Gregory Meeks, Democrat, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee on the House floor, also speaking in support of this bill. The committee's ranking Republican, Michael McCaul from Texas.
It will ensure the United States helps the people of Ukraine gather, analyze, and maintain the evidence of these war crimes. It will also put Russian troops, I think troops is a probably not the right word, these Russian monsters and their leaders on notice that the world is watching. The world is watching them right now. And we're taking names. We're taking the names of these war criminals, and we're taking the photographs, and we're taking the surveillance, and we're taking the satellite imagery to document this injustice, this crime against humanity. And we will seek justice. I'm very proud of the bipartisan efforts that our committee has made. But on this topic, I just have to, my God, I can't believe we're here even talking about this. I can't believe this is actually happening in this world, in this century. These horrific atrocities in Bucha have made one thing crystal clear. No country can remain neutral in the face of this evil. The entire world needs to rally against Mr. Putin and these war crimes. And passing this bill is a step forward to getting justice done. I was a federal prosecutor for a good part of my life, and I've dealt with a lot of victims. And I've seen a lot of really awful things that man can do to mankind. I have to say, Mr. Speaker, this is probably, in fact, absolutely the worst thing I've seen in my lifetime. And the world is watching, and history will judge us all. And all nations will judge us all by what we do here and now.
Republican Congressman Michael McCaul on the House floor. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland promising the Justice Department will take every step it can to ensure any war crimes committed by Russian leaders are punished. Garland also announcing that the Justice Department has charged a Russian oligarch with sanctions violations. Garland speaking from the Justice Department in Washington.
The Justice Department will continue to work alongside our international partners to hold accountable those who break our laws, threaten our national security, and harm our allies. Our message to those who continue to enable the Russian regime through their criminal conduct is this. It does not matter how far you sail your yacht. It does not matter how well you conceal your assets. It does not matter how cleverly you write your malware or hide your online activity. The Justice Department will use every available tool to find you, disrupt your plots, and hold you accountable. Finally, I cannot close without acknowledging the horrible images that all of us have seen coming out of Ukraine, particularly from Bucha this week. We have seen the dead bodies of civilians, some with bound hands, scattered in the streets. We have seen the mass graves. We have seen the bombed hospital, theater, and residential apartment buildings. The world sees what is happening in Ukraine. The Justice Department sees what is happening in Ukraine. This department has a long history of helping to hold accountable those who perpetrate war crimes. One of my predecessors, Attorney General Robert Jackson, later served as the chief American prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. Today, we are assisting international efforts to identify and hold accountable those responsible for atrocities in Ukraine, and we will continue to do so.
Attorney General Merrick Garland, the Russian oligarch, indicted, the indictment unsealed today, is Konstantin Malofeyev. Garland joined at the Justice Department by FBI Director Christopher Wray, who gave some more detail about another announcement today, the dismantling of a cybercrime operation controlled by a Russian military intelligence agency.
Today, we're announcing a sophisticated, court-authorized operation disrupting a botnet of thousands of devices controlled by the Russian government before it could do any harm. We removed malware from devices used by thousands of mostly small businesses for network security all over the world. And then we shut the door the Russians had used to get into them. Yesterday's Darknet takedown struck a blow against Russian criminals and the ecosystem of cryptocurrency tumblers, money launderers, malware purveyors, and others supporting them. The botnet disruption we're announcing today strikes a blow against Russian intelligence, the Russian government. The bot network we disrupted was built by the GRU, the Russian government's military intelligence agency, and in particular, it was the unit in the GRU known to security researchers as Sandworm Team. This GRU team, Sandworm, had implanted a specific type of malware known as Cyclops Blink on thousands of WatchGuard Technologies Firebox devices. These are security appliances, mainly firewalls, that are typically deployed in home office environments and in small to mid-sized businesses. Sandworm strung them together to use their computing power in a way that would obfuscate who was really running the network, to let them then launch malware or to orchestrate distributed denial of service attacks like the GRU has already used to attack Ukraine.
FBI Director Christopher Wray, along with the Attorney General and other officials at the Justice Department. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporting that this global botnet disruption included several businesses in the Pittsburgh region, and that the unit in Russia known as the GRU had previously been involved in cyber attacks on the 2018 Olympics in South Korea, the Ukrainian electrical grid, and other targets. And some members have been prosecuted in Pittsburgh, with the FBI has one of the nation's top cyber squads. That from the Post-Gazette. This is Washington Today. U.S. House of Representatives taking up a recommendation that two former advisors to former President Donald Trump be referred to the Justice Department on criminal contempt of Congress charges. They are former Deputy Chief of Staff Diane Scavino, former Trade Advisor Peter Navarro, for their refusal to cooperate with the House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Congressman Jamie Raskin, Democrat from Maryland, is a member of the Select Committee. He spoke on the House floor.
Two guys in the District of Columbia blowing off a congressional investigation and subpoenas into a deadly insurrection which caused multiple deaths, inflicted brutal, savage injuries on 150 of our officers who ended up with broken jaws, necks, vertebrae, noses, traumatic brain injuries, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and interrupted Congress from executing its constitutional duties by counting electoral college votes for the very first time in American history. Oh, yes, and it nearly succeeded in overthrowing the 2020 presidential election and toppling the peaceful transfer of power, perhaps for all time, as United States District Court Judge Carter wrote in a blistering opinion last week, rejecting this exact same and equally ridiculous claims of John Eastman, who helped cook up the absurd legal camouflage for this attempted coup in the first place against the American constitutional system of government.
Congressman Jamie Raskin, Democrat from Maryland, on the House floor, opposing the criminal contempt recommendation resolutions. Congressman Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, the House Minority Leader.
The riot on January 6th was wrong. Any violence on that day should be punished, as I've said before. But make no mistake, the Democrats' response is also wrong. For 15 months, Democrats have used January 6th as a blank check to trample on civil rights and congressional norms. They broke every rule, violated every norm, bullied every skeptic simply to hold on to power. Let's be honest. This is a political show trial. The committee had sent hundreds of subpoenas to private citizens for phone records, bank records, and private communications. To those who invoked their right to due process, Chairman Thompson replied, "You are part and parcel guilty to what occurred. What a disgusting betrayal of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, on the House floor. The resolution's on the floor today, the third time the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack has sent contempt charges to the House floor to be passed. The first two referrals were sent last year, were for former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and former White House Strategic Advisor Steve Bannon. The contempt referral against Bannon has resulted in an indictment, and the trial on two counts begins in July, punishable by up to 1 year in jail and up to $1,000 fine. Again, today it was Peter Navarro and Dan Scavino. This from NBC News, a federal defense contractor with a top secret security clearance who admitted he entered the Capitol during the January 6th attack was found not guilty at trial on Wednesday. Matthew Martin was acquitted by U.S. District Judge Trevor N. McFadden after a two-day bench trial. Martin was the first January 6th defendant to be fully acquitted at trial and told reporters after the not guilty verdict that he hoped to get his job back. The judge said it was not unreasonable for Martin to assume that outnumbered officers were allowing protesters to enter the Capitol. Judge said as well that the government did not show evidence of Martin crossing police lines that had been broken down by the mob before Martin arrived. That reporting from NBC News. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more top Washington stories sent right to you each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. You can sign up at c-span.org/connect. Hope you have a good night.